a lonely vegetarian, sweep you off your feet like a maid Marian, having fun like a seminarian. Oh wait, you say you're a happy Unitarian, laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian? Oh, how sweet. A
welcome to the Mount Kisco Public Library Podcast. As you may remember, last time we interviewed Megan Willen Turner, who explained, among other things, why she will not answer certain of our questions, as well as answering a lot more. So this time, we think we have a lot of questions that she will answer. Right, Maria?
Absolutely, Deirdre.
So let's dive right in. Okay. Enjoy.
Any other questions that other people wanted to...
I do have another question, and this one I hope you can answer. We know that Jen is not portrayed as a wonderful animal lover, and I myself love how he hates horses, although I myself love horses, but I was wondering if maybe you yourself had a pet goat, or whether you share any of Jen's prejudices about animals, or they seem like prejudices to me, or whether you have a pet or have had...
No, Jen's prejudices are his own, and I'm actually a big animal lover, though we don't have any pets now because we move around so frequently.
Uh-huh.
Back in Shaker Heights, Ohio, we did have the neighbor's cat who felt like he lived in our house,
uh-huh.
and that allowed us to have a sort of vicarious pet, because the cat would come in and make himself at home. He would go upstairs and into my study and lie down in the sunspot. Several times we came home and opened the door and found a cat inside.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, sometimes the neighbor would call and say, "Hello, do you have my cat?" And we'd have to go look through the house and find the cat. So that's as close as we've come to owning a pet lately. But everybody here would be very keen to have a pet if we could. And I've always desperately wanted to know how to ride horses and have never had an opportunity to learn. But Jen doesn't like them. And for obvious reasons, he doesn't like dogs either.
No. We know that he doesn't like dogs.
Right, he didn't like dogs. He didn't like dogs beforehand because of his profession. He's not keen on dogs.
Right.
And then after the Queen of Atolia, book two in the series, he's going to be even less keen on dogs.
Yes.
For a long time.
Right. Absolutely. So what else, ladies? Because I have a lot of things on the tip of my tongue, but I don't want to be hogging the microphone here. That would be unfair.
Oh, here's one question. Have you ever known anyone like Atolia or Sunis? Because I find your characters to be very real. I know we already talked about that a little bit, but I feel like, you know, it's possible that if I lived in that world, that I would see them walking down the street or something like that. You know, it's hard to believe that your characters are completely imaginary. So I was just wondering if there was anyone in your life or that you've ever met that you draw your characters from.
No, they're completely imaginary.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Right now, all of the inspirations for all of the characters have just flown right out of my head. There are certainly parts of them that come from real-life people, but there isn't any one person who contributes largely to the formation of any one character. So the interactions between the characters may be exchanges that I've seen in real life. But, you know, if I hear a conversation while I'm sitting on the bus between two people and some part of that conversation becomes an exchange between Edis and Eugenides, it wouldn't be fair to say that those people are based on a couple that were sitting behind me on a bus.
Yeah.
No, I understand. Yeah, that's cool, though.
Right. So there are lots. They're very mosaic. Lots of different people. I take little bits and pieces of lots of different people and patch them into my characters.
Yeah. So I think I'll jump in.
Some of them have hair that belongs to one person and a nose that belongs to somebody else. And. earrings that I passed on the street and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to just jump in with another one on the list. We were wondering, did you always want to be a writer, and how did you become a writer?
That's a long story. Let me say first that when you look in the back of books, there's usually a little biography of the author.
Right.
And frequently, when you're looking at the little biographies of the authors of children's books, they talk about how early in their life they started telling stories and writing stories. So Diana Wynne Jones, for instance, amused her little sisters almost from their birth with stories. Right. And Joan Aiken wrote her first novel when she was 17.
Wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I didn't do that. I didn't do that at all. And reading those biographies really made me feel like the fact that I hadn't produced the novel by the time I was 10 meant I was pretty much washed up as an author. And so I didn't really think about it a lot when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. The people in those biographies were so unlike me that I didn't really conceive of myself as growing up to be an author someday. It wasn't until I was in college and needed to produce a senior project in order to graduate from the University of Chicago that I decided that I would write fiction for my senior project and that it would be children's stories. And it wasn't until I was 28 that I really wrote down anything worth keeping. And those were the stories in Instead of Three Wishes.
Wow.
So when I talk to people, when I go to schools and I visit schools and I talk about, you know, what are you going to do when you grow up, I like to remind people that lots of times people don't decide what they're going to do when they grow up until they grow up. Some people don't decide what they're going to do with their lives until they're 50. Some people who start writing and write great books don't start writing until they're in their 70s. I think we pressure young people to make a plan for what they want to be and what they want to do with their lives sometimes long before they could possibly have any idea that, you know, what they really want to be is a certified public accountant. I mean, who knows when they're 11 that they're going to really enjoy being a CPA. but it's when they're 11 that we say to them, so what are you going to be when you grow up? And I remind people that they don't have to have an answer for that until they're much, much older, and that as they get older, they're very likely to find something they really like to do. But the chances that you'll find that something when you're 11 are actually pretty slim. Most people don't figure out what they want to do. When did you know you wanted to be a librarian?
Good God. That's
okay.
Funny.
Well, I guess for me, this is a recent thing because I'm a very new librarian. So I really didn't know that I really wanted to be a librarian until about a year and a half ago. So, you know, I was in my late 20s when I figured that out.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I actually came at it sort of sideways because when I was quite little, like maybe as young as 5 or 6, people would ask me, what you want to be? And I said, well, I'm going to be in a library. And I'm going to write books and put beautiful pictures in them, and then I'm going to give them to the children to read. So
wow.
My whole
idea nice was, to have a goal in life.
Well, actually, what I loved was books as, well, not as objects. I don't want to say that. Books as stories, but definitely with the illustrations. So when I was really little, I wanted to be an illustrator. But I thought it would be very cool to be in a library and give kids great books. So now I'm doing that and it's great. But I trained actually, well, in languages, foreign languages and art of various types. And my degree was in dance archives. So
wow.
Getting to be a librarian for children in a public library was a little different, but it's wonderful. Yeah. So
there were a few detours there
between
five and librarian.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I guess I might be one of those people. I always knew that I wanted to write, but I always knew I was never going to make a living at it, so I wanted to teach, and I got sidetracked also and ended up getting a dual degree in law and library science. I don't know that I should be telling everybody all this about myself. I'm not all that interesting, but anyway.
Talking about you.
But yeah, exactly. But anyway, I love working in public libraries, and I love working with kids. And I find that it's something that definitely feeds creativity.
My idea of what a librarian should do is reader's advisory. Yeah, I think you should just wander around your stacks all the time. Doing book talks spontaneously, you know, every 5 feet you turn, do another book talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
But my nightmare is that librarianing is cataloging books.
Oh, that's so interesting, because some of the most creative people ever are catalogers, and it is kind of
that would be like homework all day, every day.
Yeah.
It would be like French homework all day, every day for
like
me.
Very strange math homework. Yes. That's more like what
it
is.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah, actually, there's so many different systems of cataloging. It's kind of fascinating. And I don't know, did you study Ranganathan, Maria?
No.
I didn't study him.
Oh, no.
I've only heard about him.
But he was an Indian philosopher come cataloger. And he wanted to classify books in libraries according to, like, earth, air, fire, water, and different...
You're joking. What century was this?
I think the early 20th.
Early 20th, yeah.
I haven't taken cataloging yet. That's
why. Okay, yeah. Maria's
in library school,
so...
Yeah, but he's very famous in the library field. He has this quote that everyone quotes all the time, a book for every reader, the right book for the right reader. Like,
well,
yeah.
that's a sentiment I can get behind.
Yes.
Yay.
So get back to the books now.
Yes.
Let's get away from us.
From books to maybe maps or the combination thereof, because we were completely thrilled that there is going to be a map in the new Megan Whelan Turner book. Yes?
No.
No?
No?
No.
That was an evil lie? That somebody propagated on the internet. No maps.
This is me not telling. No map.
Okay.
Oh.
No, I did not get the map finished, and I have very particular ideas about what I wanted on the map, and as a result, it came down to either holding up production or. Just going without the map.
Well,
I decided it was probably better to get the book out in something less than 6 years.
Okay. So maybe a map in a future volume?
Maybe a map in the future volume.
Okay, very good.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
We will indeed.
So. Yeah, sorry about that.
No,
it's
that's
those
okay.
pesky little islands.
We would have been thrilled about a map, but... We can wait. We're willing.
Thank
to
you for being patient.
Books and
I really do appreciate how patiently everybody waits in between books.
No, we understand that it takes a while to craft them and to get them the way you want them to be, and that's the way we want to read them too.
Yeah, I feel like you could always tell when a book is rushed, like either that the writer didn't have enough time or. It wasn't edited quite as well as it could have been. So it's nice to know that there are authors out there who really take their time and really work on building their characters and their worlds and making the best book.
My worst nightmare is that I'll have a really, really, really good idea too late.
Oh, no.
And so far that hasn't happened. I have, in a couple of my short stories, I've had a couple of smallish ideas that if I were writing the stories today, I would incorporate into them.
Uh-huh.
But so far, I have not yet had the great moment of enlightenment when I realized that X should have happened in a story, and it's too late because it's already gone to press. That one hasn't happened yet. I hope it never happens. Because that is my big nightmare, that I'll have a really good idea 3 years after I publish a book.
Oh, dear. Well, Speaking of short stories, though, one thing that some of the people on Sunas and I and Maria, we've been noticing that there's a lot of delicious food in your stories and your books. And sometimes reading The Thief makes me hungry, all those olives and things. But particularly instead of Three Wishes itself and The Baker King. And we wondered if you are an avid baker. Are you just like good food, or there's a particular...
I think I just like good food.
Oh, okay.
I do bake, okay. and I like to cook, but I wouldn't say I'm an avid baker.
Oh.
I'm a sort of haphazard, works in bursts, sometimes has pizza three times a week kind of baker.
Oh, I love pizza.
Food supplies go up and down, but I do like food, and I do like food that tastes good, that is carefully prepared. I like to appreciate food that's done really, really, really well. I think that if you're eating it, you really ought to be enjoying it, and if it's not enjoyable, you really shouldn't be eating it.
Yeah.
Well, too many times I think people eat food that they don't particularly like or don't particularly want because they have 45 minutes and they've got to get something to eat because
uh-huh.
they're going to spend the whole day doing something and they only have a little while. And then
uh-huh.
we end up, because of our rush, eating really bad food. And I think that's a shame.
Yeah.
Now don't get me started on food. Yes, you should eat good food. Right.
Okay, no more microwaved burritos for me, I guess. Although, actually...
Well, I should hope not.
I actually really like some of them.
I say that, but I used to very carefully make burritos to be microwaved because they're a great traveling food item.
Yeah.
You can make a bean and cheese burrito first thing in the morning and wrap it up and send it off in a packed lunch, and as long as there's a microwave on the other end, it's one of those perfect traveling foods. So you're allowed to have your microwave burrito. That's okay.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, as long as they're good ones. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I sort of wanted to ask a question about the political structure in your books, but I'm sure this is probably one of those questions that you won't answer, which is fine. I find it very interesting, the all the political activity that goes on. I don't know if this is too spoilerish or not. You know how Edis has her ministers, and Atolia is kind of, I'm sure she has her ministers as well, but she seems more solitary in her rule. And Sunas has the Magus. So am I right to assume that they do have very different political structures in all three countries?
Well, I think every ruler has ministers.
Mm-hmm.
They each have a different relationship with their ministers. But all three of the countries have sovereigns and have what we would call nobles. In my world, those people are called patronoi, and the alternative is to be an okloi, or patrons is another word that they call themselves, and they're landholders. The thing that differentiates the haves from the have-nots is whether or not they own property.
Right.
And that's something that stems directly from my understanding of Athenian democracy. That in the archaic and the classic period, whether or not you had a vote in political matters depended on whether or not you had land. So that's pretty much the dividing line in these countries. You either have land or you don't have land. But there was an exchange between two of the characters and the king of Aetolia that talked a little bit about the way the world has been changing lately. In that you have a merchant class that's been rising.
Right.
Uh-huh. And they are people who don't have land, but are gaining more and more power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not unusual in the development of a lot of societies, that you move from a feudal society to a society where you have different classes and social classes and they interact. And I did want to include some of that complexity in the background of my stories. Because, well, for one thing, my stories aren't, although they're sort of
their fantasies and they're swashbuckling and they have swords and things like that. They aren't set in a world that we might have found in 400 AD. They're set in a sort of Renaissance world or Byzantine world, a world where gunpowder was introduced some time ago and people are still assimilating it into their battle tactics and into what it's going to mean for the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's not swords and knives, in spite of the fact that it's a fantasy. And that was deliberate. I wanted to have a world that was not based, again, on the Western European feudal system.
Yeah.
I was trying for something a little bit different.
Well, you certainly achieved it. Related to that, I have two questions. What I was going to ask was about the gods and your style of magic, because I was thinking about it, and Tolkien is actually one of my favorite authors, and I love Ursula Le Guin, and I'm finding that you have, in a way, you're on maybe one side of Tolkien and she's on the other, in that the magic in your three worlds is very much natural or based on natural forces in some way. Like your gods seem to be emanations of the natural world, much as the ancient Greek gods were. Would you say that that's what you intended? Or I also like that you don't have a ton of magic, that it's not like everywhere. People aren't always waving wands and crazy things are happening.
I think I have to say mostly the answer to that is, again, that I'm not telling.
Not telling. That's what I thought.
Not telling.
So then I'll jump to my final one, which is that there are a lot of movies being made from books right now. And we were wondering if you'd like any of your books to be made into a film, and which one you think might make a good movie, or are you thinking that that's not going to happen?
Well, I'm not holding my breath. I think that it would be tremendously fun to have them made into a movie, or to have one of the short stories made into a movie.
That would be awesome, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how you would fit all of the things that happen in the books into a movie. I imagine that it would be a lot of fun, and the visuals would certainly be great.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy watching people take out imaginary cast members.
Yeah. That's a lot of fun.
That's always fun. But no, I don't think there are any plans right now for any of them to be turned into movies.
Was there anything else?
No, I don't think so, except we did want to know whether there was any advice you might give to young people who are interested in being creative or in writing.
There is one piece of advice that I give people who are interested in writing, and that is that they think of everything they write as practice for writing. I don't think I realized until years and years and years afterwards that some of the best practice I had for writing my short stories was writing my thank you notes. And I know how much thrill and delight it is to everyone to sit down after a birthday or after a holiday and write out thank you notes, as in not any thrill at all. But they're really, really good practice. And as I said, I didn't really write anything until I wrote the collection of short stories when I was 28. And I would stand by that. I didn't do a whole lot of writing. But in retrospect, I realized that I did actually do a whole lot of writing. I did a tremendous amount of writing. All the letters that I wrote, all the thank you notes that I wrote, all the essays that I wrote for school, all the nonfiction things that I wrote, all of those things were practice in being clear and in saying exactly what I wanted to say. And I used the skill that I developed through practice when I did finally sit down to write short stories. So I really recommend that anybody who wants to write for a living realize that if they're going to increase their skill, that every single thing they write have to be practice. Even the long answers on the science questions. Those are practice for your writing every bit as much as the short stories that you might practice or the fan fiction that you write. Everything you write is practice that helps you get better. And if you write everything as if it's important and as if you need to do it as well as you can, then that skill and that practice will pay off later.
Hey, that's great.
Yeah, that's,
thank
yeah,
you
nice.
Very much.
Yeah, that's my, you know, that's my condescending advice for the day. Practice.
Not at all. That's wonderful. And with that, I guess we have to end and let you get ready for dinner, and we're going to do likewise a few hours yes. later.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a great break from proofreading galleys. It was very nice to talk to you guys.
Yes, thank you for taking the time to answer our questions.
Yes, thank you very much for talking to us, and have wonderful holidays, Megan.
Yes,
well, thank
so
you, and you guys have a good holiday, too.
Again, many thanks to Megan for talking with us today. And thanks to Kyle and the Iliad for our opening song, to Cursor Minor for our closing song, and to you for listening to our podcast today. And we hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please vote for us on Podcast Alley. Go to podcastalley.com, look up Kisco, K-I-S-C-O. We will be the only podcast you see, and you can cast your vote.
Make sure you listen to our next podcast, where we interview the awesome Carrie Ryan, the author of The Forest of the Hands and Teeth. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful new year. Goodbye.
It's a lot of fun, yeah, you will see. You can learn a lot about the world that we live in the public library. The library, the library. It's a place where books are free. The library, the library. It's a lot better than watching TV.